Multi-State Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, Sepher Akbar Review, Question 1. 6 years ago, Testator retired from his work as a business executive. Testator continued to serve as a trustee of several non-profit organizations, and manage all of his own financial affairs. He maintained these activities until his death. 5 years ago, Testator hired a housekeeper, Harriet. 4 years ago, Harriet began to ask Testator to provide for her in his will. She also began to interfere with Testator's relationship with his daughter, Doris. When Doris called, Harriet sometimes falsely told her that Testator was sleeping and could not talk on the phone. When Doris came to visit Testator, Harriet often stayed in the room to overhear their conversations. Harriet also made critical remarks about Doris to Testator, and told him that Doris should visit him more regularly. On a number of occasions, Harriet threatened to quit if Testator did not provide for her in his will. These threats made Testator fearful, particularly during the last year of his life, when his declining health made him increasingly dependent on Harriet. 6 months ago, Harriet again threatened to quit if Testator did not provide for her in his will, and told Testator that he should see her attorney. Testator told Harriet, "Stop bothering me. I'll see my own attorney." 3 months ago, Testator executed a will, in accordance with the applicable statute of wills. The will was drafted by Testator's attorney, pursuant to Testator's handwritten instructions. The will specified as follows: "I leave my estate in equal shares to my housekeeper, Harriet, and my daughter, Doris." This is the only will Testator ever executed. Testator recently died at age 78. Testator left a substantial estate. Both Harriet and Doris survived Testator. Testator was also survived by a son, Sam, a grandchild, Ella, who was the child of Doris, and a grandchild, Fred, who was the child of Testator's son, Bob. Both Testator's spouse and Bob predeceased Testator. Testator and Sam had been estranged for several years prior to the time of Testator's death. 1. Is the will invalid in whole, or in part? Explain. 2. Assuming the will is invalid in whole, to whom, and in what shares, should Testator's estate be distributed? Explain. 3. Assuming the will is invalid in part, to whom, and in what shares, should Testator's estate be distributed? Explain. Multi-State Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, Sepher Akbar Review, Answer Analysis of Question 1, Wills and Estates. Issue 1. Did a housekeeper unduly influence a testator to make her a beneficiary under his will? Issue 2. If a person unduly influenced the testator, is his will partially or entirely invalid? Issue 3a. To whom should testator's estate be distributed if the will is entirely invalid? Issue 3b. To whom should testator's estate be distributed if the will is partially invalid? Answer discussion. Testator's will is invalid, in whole, or in part, if it was the product of undue influence. Here, the facts are not conclusive, but may support an undue influence finding. If the will is valid, the estate will pass in equal shares to Harriet and Doris. If the bequest to Harriet was the product of undue influence, the court may invalidate the entire will, or only Harriet's bequest. If the entire will is invalidated, the estate would pass under the laws of intestate succession. Doris, Sam, and Fred, who would take as the representative of his deceased parent Bob, would take equal one-third shares. If only the bequest to Harriet is invalidated, one half of the estate would pass to Doris under the will, and the remaining half would pass either to Doris, as the remaining res jure legatee, or if the common law, no residue of a residue rule is applied to Doris, Sam and Fred under the laws of intestate succession. In that case, Doris would take two-thirds of the estate, and Sam and Fred would each take one-sixth. Explanation to point 1, 35-45% of your score. The court may find that testator's will, in whole, or in part, was the product of Harriet's undue influence. If a will, or portion of a will is the product of undue influence, it may be set aside. Undue influence occurs when the wrongdoer exerted such influence over the testator that it overcame the testator's free will, and caused the testator to make a donative transfer that the testator would not otherwise have made. The burden of establishing undue influence is on the will contestant, who must show that, 1, the testator was susceptible to undue influence, 2, the alleged wrongdoer had the opportunity to exert undue influence upon the testator, 3, the alleged wrongdoer had a disposition to exert undue influence, and, 4, the will appears to be the product of undue influence. Undue influence may be established by circumstantial evidence. The facts of this case, if proven at trial, would certainly establish that Harriet had opportunity and a disposition to influence testator. Harriet lived in testator's home, criticized and limited his contacts with Doris, a natural object of testator's bounty, and urged him repeatedly to make a will in her favor. The will contestant should also be able to show that the bequest to Harriet was linked to her attempts to influence the will, as testator executed the will only after Harriet threatened to quit, and at a time when he had become increasingly dependent upon her. Testator also bequeathed to Harriet, an employee who was not the natural object of his bounty, one half of his probate estate. The facts do not so clearly establish testator's susceptibility to undue influence. On the one hand, testator was increasingly ill, and dependent on Harriet. He also agreed to see an attorney after Harriet threatened him. On the other hand, testator maintained control over his financial affairs until his death, continued to play an active role as trustee of various non-profits, refused to see the attorney Harriet suggested, and communicated his dispositional plan to his own attorney through handwritten instructions. Because the evidence is inconclusive, the outcome might depend on who bears the burden of proof. Normally, this rests on the party challenging the will. However, in many jurisdictions, a presumption of undue influence arises when there is a confidential relationship between the testator and the alleged influencer, and suspicious circumstances surround the drafting of the will. Most of the cases involving confidential relationships involve attorneys and close relatives. It is not clear that a confidential relationship between testator and Harriet could be established in this case. But if it were, then the burden of proof on the issue of undue influence would shift to Harriet. Explanation to point 2, 10-20% of your score. If the court finds that the bequest to Harriet was the product of undue influence, it may invalidate the entire will, or only the bequest to Harriet. A finding of undue influence may lead a court to invalidate the entire will, or only a portion of it. Most courts will invalidate only those portions that are infected by undue influence. Clearly, if there was undue influence, it affected the bequest to Harriet, and that bequest should be invalidated. It is less clear whether the entire will was infected by Harriet's undue influence. Given his estrangement from Sam, it is possible that testator would have left his entire estate to Doris, had he not left a one-half share to Harriet. However, it is also possible that testator might have left a share of the estate to his grandchild Fred. The facts do not show that testator was estranged from either Fred, or Fred's deceased parent, Bob. Testator might also have left a share to Sam's child, Ella, or even to Sam himself. Indeed, testator might not have executed a will at all. Given this uncertainty, the court might invalidate the entire will, or only the bequest to Harriet. Explanation to point 3a. 10-20% of your score. If the entire will is invalidated, testator's estate would pass to his heirs, Doris, Sam, and Fred. Assuming that the court invalidates the entire will, as the product of undue influence, testator's estate will be distributed to his heirs. In every jurisdiction, testator's heirs would be his two surviving children, Doris and Sam, and his grandchild, Fred, who takes as the representative of testator's deceased child, Bob. Doris's child, Ella, would not take as an heir, because Doris survived testator, and there is no basis for Ella to represent her mother. Explanation to point 3b. 15-25% of your score. If the bequest to Harriet alone is invalidated, Harriet's one-half share of the estate would either pass to Doris in its entirety, or be distributed equally to Doris, Sam, and Fred, depending on whether the jurisdiction applies the common law, no residue of a residue rule. When a residuary bequest fails, the question arises as to whether the invalidated share passes to the testator's heirs, or to the remaining residuary legatees. Under the common law, no residue of a residue rule, the invalid share passes to the testator's heirs. The theory behind this approach is that, if the invalid share were to pass to the remaining residuary legatee, it would increase her share without an executed bequest, and thus violate the policies that underlie typical statutory execution requirements. Under the common law approach, Doris would take one half of the estate under the will, and the remaining half would be distributed in equal shares to Doris, Sam, and Fred, under the law of intestate succession. Many courts today reject the common law rule, theorizing that the testator's execution of a will evidence is an intention to benefit the legatees named in the will, to the exclusion of heirs, particularly, would-be heirs not mentioned in the will. This residue of a residue approach has been adopted in Uniform Probate Code Section 2604. Under this approach, Harriet's invalid share would go to Doris. The only other is a residuary legatee. Neither Sam nor Fred would take a share of testator's estate. Multistate Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review. Question 2. Last month, Paul attended a fundraising lunch at library, where he purchased and ate a chicken salad sandwich. Later that day, he became severely ill, and was diagnosed with food poisoning. As a result of the food poisoning, Paul developed a permanent digestive disorder. Several other people also became sick after eating at the lunch, and the health department determined that the chicken salad was contaminated with Salmonella bacteria. According to the health department, raw chicken often contains Salmonella bacteria. Although the risk of Salmonella contamination cannot be eliminated, proper preparation and cooking can ensure that the chicken is safe for eating. The chicken must be thoroughly cooked, and all utensils or surfaces that come in contact with raw chicken must be thoroughly cleaned with hot water and soap before further use. The Reading Club had initiated and planned the library's first and only fundraising lunch. Ann, Bill, and Chuck independently volunteered to make the chicken salad. Each made a separate batch of salad, using their own recipes and working individually, at their own homes. Another volunteer combined the three batches of salad at library, and a library employee sold sandwiches at the lunch. All lunch profits went to library. Ann, Bill, and Chuck each purchased their chicken from supermarket. The chicken was contained in packages labeled with a prominent warning, describing the risk of Salmonella contamination, and the precautions necessary to avoid those risks. A health department spokesperson has said that someone who made the chicken salad did not take proper precautions. Ann, Bill, and Chuck all claim they took the proper precautions. Paul has consulted an attorney about bringing a tort action against 1. Library, 2. Supermarket, and 3. Ann, Bill, and Chuck. If Paul can prove only the facts outlined above, 1. Can library be found liable to Paul under a strict liability theory? Explain. 2. Can supermarket be found liable to Paul under a strict liability theory? Explain. 3. Can Ann, Bill, and Chuck be found liable to Paul under either a strict liability or negligence theory? Explain. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Sepper Akbar Review, Answer Analysis of Question 2, Torts. Issue, 1. Is library, an occasional non-commercial product seller, strictly liable to Paul? Issue 2a. Is supermarket, a commercial product seller, strictly liable for injuries to Paul, when it did not produce or alter the defective product, and did not sell the product to Paul? Issue 2b. Is a product defective, when the risk cannot be eliminated, and the product comes with adequate warnings? Issue 3. May Paul recover damages from any of Ann, Bill, or Chuck, when he cannot show who was negligent, and caused his injury? Answer discussion. If Paul proves only the facts given in the problem, he will not be able to recover damages from any of the parties. Paul cannot recover damages from a library, because as an occasional, non-commercial seller of food, library is not strictly liable for injuries caused by its food. Paul cannot recover damages from supermarket either. Although supermarket, as a commercial seller, is strictly liable for defective products, here the product was not defective, as it was prominently labeled as possibly having salmonella bacteria, and the risk of salmonella contamination cannot be eliminated. There is evidence that at least one of Ann, Bill, or Chuck was negligent in the preparation of the chicken salad that caused Paul's injury. If Paul could establish which party was negligent, he could recover damages from that individual. However, Paul cannot establish which party was negligent, and the doctrines of res ipsa loquitur, alternative liability, and joint enterprise liability, are all unavailable to assist Paul in his claim. Explanation to point 1, 15-25% of your score. Strict products liability is only available against commercial product sellers. Thus library cannot be liable, because it is not a commercial product seller. One who sells any product in a defective condition unreasonably dangerous to the user or consumer is subject to liability for physical harm thereby caused. The chicken salad sandwich that Paul consumed was unreasonably dangerous to the consumer, because it contained salmonella bacteria. Thus, if library had been a restaurant, or other commercial entity, Paul would have a viable products liability action. In that action, he would not need to establish negligence on the part of library. However, a strict products liability action is only available against a person engaged in the business of selling products for use or consumption. Because the facts do not establish that library is a commercial seller, Paul's action against library will fail on that ground. Explanation to point 2a. 10-20% of your score. A commercial seller may be found strictly liable for a defective product it sells, even if the seller did not produce the product and the injured party did not purchase the product from the seller. Strict products liability applies to all commercial sellers. Even a retailer who has no control over the design and manufacture of a product may be found strictly liable if the retailer sells a defective product. Because supermarket is a commercial seller, it may be found liable if the chicken it sold was defective. The fact that Paul did not purchase the chicken himself does not alter the result. Modern products liability law applies to bystanders as well as purchasers. The privity of contract approach has been abandoned. Strict liability is available for injuries to an ultimate user or consumer. Explanation to point 2b. 15-25% of your score. A product seller is liable only for a defective product, because the risk of salmonella contamination cannot be eliminated from raw chicken, and the product was accompanied by detailed warnings. The chicken sold by supermarket was not defective. A product is defective when it is unreasonably dangerous. A product may be defective because it has a manufacturing defect, because it is defective in design, or because it provides inadequate instructions or warnings. The chicken sold by supermarket carried adequate warnings of the risk of salmonella contamination and instructions on how to cook the chicken to ensure that it was safe for eating. The chicken sold by supermarket did not contain a manufacturing or design defect, as the risk of salmonella contamination is inherent in raw chicken, and cannot be eliminated. Thus, the chicken conformed to the producer's specifications, and those specifications could not be altered. Because the chicken was not defective, Paul cannot recover damages from supermarket. Explanation to point 3, 25-35% of your score. Paul could recover on a negligence theory against Ann, Bill, or Chuck, if, and only if he could show which of them was negligent in preparing the chicken salad. Furthermore, merely the fact that these batches of chicken salad were mixed together doesn't make Ann, Bill, and Chuck, joint tortfeasors, because there is no evidence they were engaged in a joint venture or joint enterprise. In fact, they acted independently of one another. Paul cannot recover on a strict liability theory, because Ann, Bill, and Chuck are not product sellers. The health department said that someone who made the chicken salad that Paul ate used improper precautions. The evidence thus shows that one of Ann, Bill, or Chuck was negligent, that is, failed to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances. Even though Paul cannot show how the negligence occurred, he could still recover if only one individual had made the salad. In such a situation, Paul could use the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, which permits the jury to infer negligence, when the event is of a kind which ordinarily does not occur in the absence of negligence. Other responsible causes are sufficiently eliminated by the evidence, and the indicated negligence is within the scope of the defendant's duty to the plaintiff. Paul can meet the first and third of these requirements. The health department has said that salmonella contamination does not occur when chicken is cooked and prepared properly. The salad preparers owed a duty to Paul, as he was a lunch patron who would foreseeably have been expected to consume the chicken salad. However, Paul cannot establish that any one defendant had control of the chicken salad, as there were two other individuals who made salad independently. Nor can Paul show that Ann, Bill, and Chuck have better information about who was negligent, or are engaged in a conspiracy of silence. There are other doctrines that permit the jury to find a defendant liable, even when there is more than one defendant, and the plaintiff cannot show which defendant's conduct caused his injury. However, none of these doctrines would help Paul to establish the liability of Ann, Bill, or Chuck. The alternative liability doctrine, which permits the jury to find two defendants liable when each was negligent, and either individual could have caused the plaintiff's injuries, is unavailable because Paul cannot show that all defendants were negligent. The joint venture or joint enterprise doctrine allows the jury to impute one defendant's negligence to other defendants who are engaged in a common project or enterprise, and who have an explicit or implied understanding about how the project is to be carried out. However, Paul cannot show that Ann, Bill, and Chuck had any common understanding. The facts state that Ann, Bill, and Chuck acted independently in making their respective batches of chicken salad. Thus, because Paul cannot show which defendant was negligent, he cannot recover damages from Ann, Bill, or Chuck. A strict products liability action would not be available against Ann, Bill, or Chuck, because none is a product seller. Moreover, even if a products liability action were available, it would still be necessary to identify the source of the defective product, here the contaminated chicken salad. Multistate Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Question 3. Husband and wife married 10 years ago. Shortly thereafter, husband adopted wife's two children, Amy, age 6, and Bert, age 9. Neither Amy nor Bert has ever had a relationship with their biological father. 1 year ago, husband and wife were divorced. The divorce decree provided that, 1, husband shall pay wife $1,000 per month in child support for Amy, until Amy is 18 years old. 2. Husband shall pay child support, in the form of college tuition, up to $20,000 per year, for both Amy and Bert. 3 months ago, husband stopped making support payments for Amy, and college tuition payments for Bert. Husband stopped paying for two reasons. First, husband was disinclined to continue supporting Amy and Bert, now ages 16 and 19, respectively. Since the divorce, husband has quarreled frequently with both children. Bert also disobeyed husband, and joined a rock band that plays at a local bar 4 nights per week. Since joining the band, Bert's college grades slipped from A's to C's, and he was arrested for driving while intoxicated. Bert has refused husband's requests that he leave the band, and devote more time to study. Second, husband, who formerly worked 40 to 60 hours per week, is now working only 10 to 20 hours per week so that he can finish writing a novel. Husband has worked on the novel sporadically over the past few years, but has not had time to complete it. Husband's current income is only 25% of what it was when he was employed full-time. Wife, who works full-time at the job she has held since her marriage to husband, has neither reduced nor increased her income since the divorce. Since husband stopped paying support, she has been borrowing money to meet the family's expenses. Wife recently filed a petition to obtain a judgment against husband for the child support arrears, and Bert's tuition. Husband responded with a petition seeking 1. A dissolution of his adoption of Amy and Bert on the basis of irreconcilable differences, 2. Downward modification of all of his support obligations, on account of his reduced income, retroactive to the date on which husband stopped making support and tuition payments, and, 3, a declaration that husband need not pay Bert's college tuition, so long as Bert continues to perform in a rock band. The age of majority in the state is 18. The trial court entered judgment in favor of wife, and denied husband's petition in all respects. Did the trial court err? Explain. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review, answer analysis of question 3, family law. Issue 1. May an adoptive parent dissolve the adoption of a stepchild based on a quarrelsome relationship with the child? Issue 2. May a support obligator obtain retroactive modification of a support obligation? Issue 3. May a support obligator obtain downward modification of his future support obligation, based on a voluntary reduction of his income? Issue 4. May a divorced parent of a 19-year-old college student refuse to support that student when the student has refused to obey reasonable parental commands? Answer discussion. A quarrelsome relationship with an adoptee is not a valid basis for dissolving an adoption. Husband is thus obligated to support Anne and Bert. Moreover, because retroactive modification of a child support obligation is forbidden by federal law, husband may not obtain termination or reduction of his support obligation for the period before he sought modification. Modification of a future support obligation may be obtained based on a substantial change in circumstances, but a voluntary reduction in income does not warrant downward modification, unless it was made in good faith. Many courts also take the needs and interests of the supported child into account. Thus, the court probably did not err in denying husband's petition to modify his obligation to support Anne. But the court probably did err in denying husband's petition to modify his obligation to Bert, as Bert, an employable college student, had refused to obey reasonable parental commands. Explanation to point 1, 20-30% of your score. The court did not err in refusing to dissolve husband's adoption of Anne and Bert. An adoption order works as a complete and final transfer of parental rights and responsibilities. Traditionally, an adoption order could not be dissolved for any reason. In recent years, Some states have enacted statutes authorizing dissolution of adoption in special circumstances, such as the discovery of an undisclosed mental or physical illness. Step-parent adoptions are no easier to undo than stranger adoptions. In evaluating dissolution claims, courts typically look to the length of the relationship, the child's needs, and the parent's motives. Here, husband has been Anne's and Bert's parent for more than a decade, and the only father they have known. Anne needs husband's continuing support. The fact that husband has reduced his income strongly suggests that he seeks dissolution, at least in part for financial reasons. Moreover, the only reason that husband can offer for dissolution, the fact that he had disagreements with teenagers Anne and Bert, is clearly inadequate. The trial court thus did not err in denying husband's petition to dissolve the adoption. Explanation to point 2, 10-15% of your score. The court did not err in refusing to retroactively modify husband's support obligation. Federal law absolutely forbids retroactive modification of child support obligations. The trial court thus did not err in refusing to retroactively modify husband's child support obligation. Additionally, state courts have long held that the obligation to pay accrued and unpaid installments of child support may not ordinarily be modified. If the hardship is particularly severe, the courts have sometimes devised a way to protect the obligator, but in most instances the courts hold that retroactive modification of this kind is beyond their power, and indeed the governing statute may so provide. Here, because wife commenced an enforcement action within a few months of when husband ceased making payments, and thereby limited the accrual of arrears, husband has no basis for establishing a particularly severe hardship. Explanation to point 3, 25-35% of your score. The trial court probably did not err in refusing to reduce husband's future support obligation to Anne. A support obligator's voluntary income reduction cannot be used to obtain downward modification of his future support obligation, unless the reduction was made in good faith. Even a good faith income reduction may be inadequate to obtain downward modification, if the court finds that the children would suffer hardship without an offsetting benefit. In order to obtain modification of a future support obligation, the petitioner must show a substantial change in circumstances. Courts will generally find that a significant involuntary income reduction represents a substantial change warranting relief. But when the income loss is voluntary, they invariably require a showing that the reduction was made in good faith, and not for the purpose of depriving the child or punishing the custodial parent. Some courts will grant downward modification based solely on a showing of good faith, on the theory that, if a married parent can reduce his income, even if it negatively affects his children's living standard, a divorced parent should have the same right. Others will not grant downward modification if the support reduction would impose a significant hardship on the children. Many take a multi-factor approach that balances the short and long-term interests of both parent and child. If the court were to consider hardship, or engage in an interest balancing analysis, the facts support denial of husband's petition. A temporary income reduction for training that will produce a future income gain is sometimes a valid basis for modification. However, husband's income reduction does not have any obvious endpoint, nor is it calculated to give the children future benefits. Even if husband succeeds in becoming a successful novelist, the children's ages, 16 and 19, would likely preclude a higher future support award to offset the current income loss. Wife, who already works full-time, cannot easily make up the lost income, nor can she continue to borrow indefinitely. But husband could easily defer his plan to write a novel, or reduce his income much less drastically. Even if the court looked only at whether the income reduction was made in good faith, there is evidence to support denying husband's petition. Although husband's prior work on the novel provides evidence of good faith, the timing of the decision to reduce his income, the very same time that he wanted to stop supporting Anne and Bert, is suspect, and suggests bad faith. Thus, the court probably did not err in denying husband's petition to modify his support obligation to Anne. Explanation to point 4, 15-20% of your score. Because the support rights of an employable child are contingent on compliance with reasonable parental demands, the trial court probably erred in denying husband's request for future modification of his support obligation to Bert. In a number of states, a divorced parent may be required to provide college or other educational support for a child over the age of majority. But both married and divorced parents may terminate support to employable children who disobey reasonable parental commands. Husband's commands to Bert seem reasonable and calculated to serve Bert's best interests. A regular, late-night job at a bar would either prevent Bert from getting enough sleep, or prevent him from attending morning classes. The fact that Bert's grades have fallen supports husband's view that Bert cannot keep up with his studying while performing with the band. Bert's arrest for driving while intoxicated also suggests that he should not be working in a bar. The evidence thus suggests that the trial court erred in denying husband's request for modification of his college tuition obligation to Bert. Multi-state essay questions and answers. February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Question 4. Victor was taken by ambulance to a hospital. Standard hospital practice requires the admitting nurse in the emergency room to record all information provided by a patient about the cause of the patient's illness or injury. Following that practice, the admitting nurse asked Victor, "What happened?" Victor responded, "I was stabbed with a big knife. Dan did it." Nurse immediately wrote Victor's statement in the appropriate place in the hospital record. 1 week after his hospital admission, Victor unexpectedly died as a result of the stab wound. Dan was charged with Victor's murder. When Victor's wife heard of Dan's arrest, she was shocked. She told Friend, "When Victor and I were alone together in the hospital, he told me who stabbed him, and it wasn't Dan." But wife refused to tell Friend whom Victor had identified as his assailant. During the trial, in order to prove that Dan stabbed Victor, the prosecutor offered the hospital record made by nurse that contained Victor's statement that Dan stabbed him. The prosecutor cannot locate nurse to testify at trial. Defense counsel objected to admission of the hospital record and the statements in it, but the court overruled the objection. During the presentation of Dan's case, defense counsel suggested that Victor had been attacked by stepson, wife's child by a previous marriage. Defense counsel called wife as a witness, and questioned her concerning Victor's statement to her about the identity of his assailant. Wife refused to answer on the basis of the marital privilege. The prosecutor objected to the questions directed to wife, on the grounds that they sought to elicit hearsay. The court sustained both wife's claim of privilege and the prosecutor's hearsay objection. 1. Did the trial court err in admitting into evidence the hospital record containing Victor's statement? Explain. 2. Did the trial court err in sustaining wife's claim of privilege? Explain. 3. Did the trial court err in sustaining the prosecutor's hearsay objection to wife's testimony? Explain. Multi-state essay questions and answers. February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Answer Analysis of Question 4, Evidence. Issue 1A. When a hospital record is offered into evidence to prove the truth of an out-of-court statement contained therein, must the record itself, the out-of-court statement, or both, be covered by a hearsay exception? Issue 1B. Is nurse's notation of Victor's statement a business record that can be admitted to prove the content of Victor's statement? Issue 1C. Is Victor's statement, which relates both to the general cause of his injuries and to the identity of the person causing the injuries, admissible to prove the truth of the matter stated? Issue 2. May a spouse assert the marital privilege in order not to testify with respect to communications with the deceased spouse. Issue 3. When a hearsay statement has been admitted, is an inconsistent hearsay statement admissible to attack the credibility of the hearsay declarant? Answer discussion. Both the hospital record and Victor's statement in it are hearsay, and each must fall within an exception to the hearsay rule, in order for Victor's statement to be admissible for its truth. The hospital record falls within the business records exception to the hearsay rule. Victor's statement that he was stabbed may fall within the hearsay exception for statements relating to medical diagnosis and treatment, but Victor's identification of Dan as his assailant is not pertinent to his medical treatment, and would not fall within the medical diagnosis or any other hearsay exception. Consequently, that portion of Victor's statement is inadmissible to prove that Dan stabbed Victor, and should have been excluded from evidence. In most jurisdictions, wife will be able to invoke the privilege for confidential marital communications, and refuse to testify to what Victor told her. In some jurisdictions, however, only the communicating spouse can invoke the privilege, so in those jurisdictions, wife would be required to testify. If wife cannot invoke the marital privilege, her testimony as to Victor's identification of his assailant is admissible, only for the purposes of impeaching Victor's hearsay declaration that Dan stabbed him. If that hearsay declaration is not admitted, Victor's statement to wife should also be excluded. Explanation to point 1a. 20-30% of your score. Because the hospital record is being offered to prove both that Victor made certain statements to nurse, and that those statements are true, it is double hearsay, and is admissible only if both the hospital record and the statements made by Victor fall within hearsay exceptions. Hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered in evidence to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Hearsay is generally inadmissible. Here, the hospital record is double hearsay, and both levels of hearsay must fall within a hearsay exception or the record is inadmissible. The record itself is the first level of hearsay. The record is an out-of-court statement, and the prosecutor is offering it to prove the truth of what it says, that Victor told nurse that Dan stabbed him. Without nurse present to prove what she heard Victor say, her out-of-court statement about Victor's words, in the form of her notation in his hospital record, is admissible only if the record falls within a hearsay exception. The prosecutor is also seeking to prove that what Victor said, that is, Dan stabbed me, is true. This is also hearsay because Victor's statement was made out of court, and is offered for its truth. Therefore, the prosecutor must show that Victor's statement falls within a hearsay exception. Explanation to point 1b. 20-30% of your score. The hospital record satisfies the business records exception to the hearsay rule. A record of acts, events, conditions, opinions, or diagnoses is admissible under the business records exception to the hearsay rule, if it is made at or near the time of the recorded event by a person with knowledge of the event. Additionally, the making of the record must occur in the course of a regularly conducted business activity, and it must be the regular practice of the business to make the record. This foundation can be introduced through the testimony of a record custodian, or other person with knowledge of the method of record keeping. It is not necessary that the person with knowledge of the matter enter testify at trial. Nurse's notation in the hospital record concerning Victor's statements to her falls within the business records exception. Nurse had personal knowledge of what Victor said, and she wrote down his statements, at or near the time that he made them. The facts state that it is the regular practice of the hospital to record this sort of information in a patient's record. Explanation to point 1c. 20-30% of your score. Victor's statement to nurse that he was stabbed may be admissible for the truth of the matter stated, because it falls within the hearsay exception for statements made for the purpose of receiving medical diagnosis and treatment. However, Victor's identification of his assailant as Dan is not admissible because it was not pertinent to diagnosis or treatment. As noted earlier, Victor's statement is itself hearsay, because the prosecutor is offering it to prove the truth of the matter asserted, that Dan stabbed Victor. Therefore, even if the hospital record is admissible to prove what Victor said, the statement should still be excluded unless Victor's statement itself falls within a hearsay exception. Statements made by a person who is seeking medical treatment are exempted from the ban on hearsay if the statements concern medical history, symptoms, or the inception or general character of the cause of the symptoms. Hence, Victor's statement to nurse about the cause of his injuries may qualify for this hearsay exception. However, the rationale for this hearsay exception is that statements made by people seeking medical treatment will generally be reliable because of the declarant's knowledge that medical diagnosis or treatment will be facilitated by such statements, or hindered if the statements are false. Thus, this hearsay exception is limited to statements that are reasonably pertinent to diagnosis or treatment. Statements which relate to the cause of the medical condition being diagnosed or treated are generally viewed as pertinent to diagnosis or treatment. Thus, Victor's statement that he was stabbed with a knife would fall within the exception and would be admissible. But statements of fault ordinarily are not admitted under this exception, because the identity of the person who was at fault in causing the injury is not relevant to the treatment that is to be given. Thus, the portion of Victor's statement identifying Dan as the assailant is inadmissible. In short, although the hospital record of what Victor said is admissible, even though it is hearsay, Victor's identification of his assailant is also hearsay, and is inadmissible because it does not fall within an exception. Therefore, the trial court should not admit the record containing that statement. Explanation to point 2, 20-30% of your score. The testimonial spousal privilege may only be asserted by a spouse who is testifying against an accused spouse. The marital confidential communications privilege can be asserted by either spouse. Wife may assert the privilege and refuse to testify concerning her confidential communications with Victor. Two evidentiary privileges apply to the marital relationship. The federal courts recognize a testimonial or witness privilege, under which a witness spouse has the right not to testify against an accused spouse in a criminal case. This privilege is inapplicable in this case, because wife has not been asked to testify against her husband Victor. The federal courts and most states also recognize a second privilege for confidential communications between spouses, when those communications occur during the marriage. The privilege protects communications during marriage, even if the marriage no longer exists, and even if one of the parties to the marriage is dead. Under the majority view, both spouses hold the privilege for all communications between them. Here, wife could invoke the privilege and be excused from testifying as to Victor's statements to her, because all the requirements of the privilege are met. Victor's statements were statements of one spouse to another in private. It appears that no one overheard them, and neither wife nor Victor revealed their exact content to anyone else. These confidential communications between spouses are protected by the privilege. Some courts, however, have taken the position that only the communicating spouse can assert the privilege. Under that minority view, wife could not assert the privilege, and would have to reveal what Victor said. Here, however, it is possible that wife will not be allowed to invoke the privilege, because she broke the confidentiality of her communications with her husband when she told friend, a third party, some of what her husband told her. The marital communications privilege is intended to protect the confidentiality of spousal discussions. Where one spouse has revealed the content of those communications to a third person, then confidentiality no longer exists, and the privilege probably should not apply. At the very least, wife might be required to testify to the fact that she has already revealed to friend that Victor told her that he was attacked by someone other than Dan. Explanation to point 3, 10-20% of your score. The prosecutor's hearsay objection to testimony about Victor's statement to wife should not have been sustained, because the court had previously admitted Victor's hearsay statement that Dan was his assailant. Once an out-of-court statement is offered for its truth, the credibility of their hearsay declarant may be attacked with an inconsistent statement by that declarant, including statements that would otherwise be hearsay. Thus, once Victor's identification of Dan as his assailant was admitted into evidence, his inconsistent statement to wife could be admitted to attack his credibility. Victor's statement to wife that Dan was not his assailant is hearsay, because it was made outside the courtroom, and could not have been admitted to prove the truth of the matter stated. Victor's statement is nonetheless admissible to impeach his credibility. On the facts, the court has admitted Victor's hearsay statement to nurse that Dan attacked him. Once a hearsay statement is admitted into evidence, the hearsay declarant's credibility may be attacked just as though the hearsay declarant were a witness at trial. In addition, any inconsistent statement made by the hearsay declarant may be admitted to impeach the declarant's credibility. Thus, if the hospital record is admitted to prove that Victor identified Dan as his assailant, then Victor's statement to wife, identifying someone else as his assailant, is admissible to attack Victor's credibility, despite the existence of the hearsay rule. Of course, wife's privilege claim may still prevent admission of the statement. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Sepher Akbar Review, Question 5. Cal is the CEO and chairman of the 12-member board of directors of Prime, Incorporated. Three other members of Prime's board of directors are also senior officers of Prime. The remaining eight members of the board are wholly independent directors. Recently, the board decided to hire a consulting firm to help Prime market a new product. The board met to consider whether to hire Wiseman Consulting or Smart Group. The board first heard from a representative of Wiseman. The Wiseman representative described some of the projects Wiseman had completed for other clients, and outlined the work it proposed to do for Prime, for $500,000. The board then heard from a representative of Smart, another consulting firm. The Smart representative described a similar work plan, and stated that Smart's proposed fee was $650,000. Either of these amounts would be a significant outlay for Prime. After the board heard both presentations, Cal disclosed to the board that he had a 25% partnership interest in Smart. Cal stated that he would not be involved in any work to be performed by Smart for Prime. He knew, but did not disclose to the board that Smart's proposed fee for this consulting assignment was substantially higher than it normally charged for comparable work. The board did not ask about the basis for Smart's proposed fee. After receiving all of this information, and no other information, the board discussed the relative merits of the two proposals for 10 minutes. The board then voted unanimously, with Cal abstaining, to hire Smart, even though hiring Smart would cost Prime approximately 30% more than hiring Wiseman. Cal was present throughout the meeting but did not participate, except to the extent indicated above. 1. Did Cal violate his duty of loyalty to Prime? Explain. 2. Assuming Cal breached his duty of loyalty to Prime, does he have any defense to liability? Explain. 3. Did the directors of Prime, other than Cal, violate the duty of care? Explain. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Sepher Akbar Review, Answer Analysis of Question 5, Corporations and LLCs. Issue 1. Did Cal violate his duty of loyalty to Prime by failing to make full disclosure of all relevant information to the board about a partnership in which he has an interest, and with which Prime is considering entering into a transaction? Issue 2. Assuming that Cal violated the duty of loyalty, does he have any defenses to avoid liability? Issue 3. Did the members of Prime's board of directors, other than Cal, violate the duty of care by approving a more expensive contract without full information. Answer discussion. Cal, the CEO, and chairman of the board of Prime, owes a fiduciary duty of loyalty to Prime. Even though Cal did not participate in the board's discussion of the consulting project, and even though the contract with Smart was approved by a majority of disinterested directors, Cal breached his duty of loyalty by failing to disclose the substantially higher fee charged to Prime by Smart, a partnership, in which Cal has a financial interest. Here, a court would be unlikely to find that the contract was objectively fair to Prime, given Smart's substantially higher fee. Therefore, Cal has no defense to a claim of breach of his duty of loyalty. The board may have violated its fiduciary duty of care when it approved the contract with Smart after only a 10-minute discussion, and without seeking or receiving full information about the fees to be charged. Explanation to point 1, 5 to 15% of your score. Cal violated the fiduciary duty of loyalty by allowing Prime to contract with a partnership, in which Cal is a partner, without fully disclosing all relevant information. Cal is the CEO and chairman of the board of Prime, and therefore has a fiduciary duty of loyalty to Prime. Here, he may have breached that duty because he stands to benefit personally if Smart is hired, since he is a partner in Smart. As a partner, he is presumably entitled to a share of any profits derived from Smart's work for Prime, even if he himself performs no services. Explanation to point 2, 40 to 50% of your score. The RMBCAE provides three safe harbors for a director who breaches his duty of loyalty. Approval by disinterested directors, approval by disinterested shareholders, or fairness. It is unlikely that any of these safe harbors will protect Cal. The revised Model Business Corporation Act includes three safe harbors that may protect a director who breaches his duty of loyalty. However, it is unlikely that any of these safe harbors will protect Cal under the facts of this case. Under the first RMBCAE safe harbor, approval by disinterested directors insulates a director's conflicting interest transaction from judicial scrutiny, if the interested director disclosed his or her interest and played no part, directly or indirectly, in the disinterested director's deliberations or vote. The statute also requires disclosure of any information in Cal's possession that an ordinarily prudent person would believe to be material to a judgment about whether or not to proceed with the transaction. Applying the first prong of this test, it appears that the Prime Board, except for Cal, was disinterested when it approved the Smart consulting contract. As far as disinterested approval is concerned, the entire Prime Board, with Cal abstaining, approved the Smart consulting contract. The facts do not suggest that any of the directors besides Cal had a personal interest in this matter. Nothing indicates that the other directors are subject to Cal's control or serve at his pleasure. Three board members are also senior officers of Prime, and therefore arguably dependent on Cal's continued goodwill, but the remaining eight are outside directors with no other connections to the corporation. Accordingly, even if there is some possible doubt as to the independence of the three inside or management directors, there is no doubt as to the independence of the other eight, all of whom voted in favor of the contract. Thus, the disinterested directors approved the transaction, and there is no evidence that Cal played any part in the deliberations or vote. However, applying the second prong of this test, Cal did not make adequate disclosure. Cal informed the board of his status as a partner in Smart before the board's approval, and therefore disclosed the fact of his conflict. However, he did not inform them that the fee to be charged by Smart was substantially higher than would ordinarily be expected for work like this. This is material information a prudent director would want to know. Therefore, because of the non-disclosure, it is unlikely that the contract with Smart can be defended on the basis of the disinterested director's approval. Under the second RMBCAE safe harbor, approval by disinterested shareholders would insulate a director's conflicting interest transaction from judicial scrutiny. No facts support that defense. Under the third RMBCA safe harbor, a duty of loyalty claim could be rebutted by proof that the transaction, judged according to the circumstances at the time of commitment, is established to have been fair to the corporation. Although there is some room to argue this point, the fact that Smart's proposed fee is substantially higher than what it normally charges for comparable work, suggests strongly that a finding of objective fairness could not be supported. Explanation to point 3, 35-45% of your score. Prime's disinterested directors likely breached their duty of care, when they approved, with minimal discussion and without full information, a contract in which a director had an interest. If the directors do not qualify for the protection of the business judgment rule, they likely will be found to have breached their duty of care in approving the contract with Smart. The business judgment rule creates a presumption that in making a business decision, the directors acted on an informed basis, in good faith, and in the honest belief that the action taken was in the best interests of the company. In this case, there is no evidence of bad faith. At least 8 directors were entirely disinterested. Nor is there any evidence that the directors did not have an honest belief that they were acting in the best interests of Prime. However, a court could find that the directors did not act on an informed basis in reviewing the two alternatives. Because the business judgment rule presumes that the board was adequately informed, a party claiming that the directors breached their duty of care has the burden of showing that the board did not have sufficient information to justify going with a higher-priced firm. The fact that Smart was going to charge Prime more than its customary rate suggests that the rate was not justified by added value. Arguably, the $150,000 price difference required the board to at least ask more about Smart's rates. Moreover, if the board had discussed the contract for more than 10 minutes, it might have realized that it lacked full information. Therefore, it is likely that a court would find that the board violated its fiduciary duty of care by approving the contract with Smart. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Question 6. Plaintiff worked for corporation. In her fifth year of employment, plaintiff complained that she had been passed over for promotion to a management position, in favor of a less experienced male colleague. Shortly after voicing her discontent, plaintiff was fired. Plaintiff sued corporation in federal district court, alleging that she was fired because of sex discrimination, in violation of federal law. Corporation filed an answer, denying the material allegations of the complaint, and alleging that plaintiff was fired for inadequate work performance. During voir dire, the court asked each prospective juror whether he or she had ever been a party to an employment discrimination lawsuit. None of the prospective jurors answered in the affirmative. At trial, plaintiff offered evidence to support her claim that she had been fired for discriminatory reasons. Her evidence included testimony by a former co-worker, relating a conversation the co-worker had with plaintiff's supervisor. In the conversation, the supervisor reportedly said that women were ill-suited for managerial positions, and that men didn't like taking orders from women. At the close of plaintiff's evidence, corporation moved for judgment as a matter of law, JMOL. The court denied the motion. Corporation then submitted its own evidence. The evidence consisted primarily of plaintiff's employment records, and testimony by plaintiff's supervisor, who testified that plaintiff's work had been rated unsatisfactory several times in the past. At the close of all the evidence, neither party made further motions. After instructions from the court, the case was submitted to the jury. The jury deliberated for several hours and then returned a verdict for plaintiff. The jury specifically found that plaintiff had been passed over for promotion, and fired as the result of sex discrimination, and that she was entitled to back pay and reinstatement. 2 days after the entry of judgment, corporation learned for the first time that the jury foreperson had previously filed and lost 2 employment discrimination lawsuits, and that, Upon learning she was part of the jury pool in this case, had said to a friend, "I'm going to get on that jury and stick it to corporation. Somebody needs to teach these companies not to discriminate." 8 days after the entry of judgment, corporation moved for a post-judgment JMOL, or, in the alternative, for a new trial. Corporation made two arguments. First, corporation claimed that the evidence it presented at trial, regarding the reasons for plaintiff's termination, was more persuasive and more credible than plaintiff's evidence. Second, corporation claimed that a new trial is required because of the jury foreperson's failure to disclose, during voir dire, her prior involvement in employment discrimination lawsuits. The trial judge believes that corporation's evidence at trial was more credible and persuasive than plaintiff's. The trial judge also believes that corporation's information about the jury foreperson's prior experiences, and her statements to her friend, is credible, and suggestive of possible juror bias. 1. Was corporation's motion for a post-judgment JMOL, procedurally proper? Explain. 2. Without regard to its procedural propriety, should the trial court grant corporation's motion for a post-judgment JMOL? Explain. 3. Should the trial court grant corporation's motion for a new trial on the ground that corporation's evidence was more persuasive and credible than plaintiff's evidence? Explain. 4. Should the trial court grant corporation's motion for a new trial because of the jury foreperson's conduct? Explain. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, SEPA Bar Review, answer analysis of question 6, civil procedure. Issue 1. Under Rule 50 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, can a post-judgment motion for judgment as a matter of law be granted if the defendant moved for judgment as a matter of law at the close of the plaintiff's evidence, but did not move for judgment as a matter of law at the close of all the evidence? Issue 2. Should a court reject a jury verdict and grant judgment as a matter of law on the basis that the losing party's evidence was more persuasive than the evidence of the party in whose favor the jury ruled? Issue 3. Should a court grant a motion for a new trial if the movant shows that the movant's evidence was more persuasive and more credible than the opponent's evidence? Issue 4. Should a court grant a motion for a new trial on the ground that a juror, during voir dire, withheld information suggesting that she would be biased against one of the parties in the suit? Answer discussion. In plaintiff's employment discrimination suit against corporation, the post-trial motion by corporation for judgment as a matter of law, JMOL, should be denied. First, corporation did not move for JMOL at the close of all the evidence as required by Rule 50 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Corporation's motion at the close of plaintiff's evidence does not satisfy the rules requirement. Second, corporation's arguments in support of the motion do not state grounds sufficient for entering judgment for corporation as a matter of law. On the other hand, corporation's motion for a new trial under Rule 59 of the FRCP may have merit. Corporation does not face a procedural bar, such as that precluding its post-judgment motion for JMOL. Corporation's alternative motion for a new trial should be granted if corporation can show that the jury's verdict was clearly against the weight of the evidence and a miscarriage of justice, or if a juror failed to reveal information indicating a strong bias against corporation. It is unlikely that corporation can show that the verdict is clearly against the weight of the evidence, but corporation should be able to show juror bias. Explanation to point 1. 20-30% of your score. Because corporation failed to move for judgment as a matter of law at the close of all the evidence, Rule 50B bars it from moving for judgment as a matter of law after trial. Under Rule 50 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, a party may make a motion for judgment as a matter of law, JMOL, also called a judgment notwithstanding the verdict or JNOV, If the party makes the motion no later than 10 days after entry of judgment, and if the party previously made a motion for JMOL at the close of all the evidence. Here, the defendant made its post-verdict motion in a timely manner, but it did not make an earlier JMOL motion at the close of all the evidence. Even though corporation moved for JMOL at the close of plaintiff's evidence, it must make the motion again at the close of the record, or it loses its right to renew the motion after entry of judgment. Moreover, a post-trial motion for judgment can be granted only on grounds advanced in such a pre-verdict motion. The federal courts are divided on how strictly to enforce Rule 50 when a party has moved for judgment at the close of the plaintiff's case, but not at the close of all the evidence. Some circuits have required strict compliance, and have held that a motion at the close of plaintiff's case is never sufficient to support a renewed motion for JMOL. Courts in these circuits would deny corporations renewed motion because no JMOL motion was made at the close of all evidence. Other circuit courts have held that if a JMOL motion was made at the close of plaintiff's case, the failure to again move at the close of all the evidence needs not be fatal to a post-verdict motion, if the evidence introduced by the defendant was brief and could not have possibly changed the court's decision on the earlier motion. This exception would not help corporation here, however, because the witness testimony it presented in defense was substantial, and could well have changed the trial court's view on the merits of the motion. If corporation had made that motion at the close of all evidence after presenting its own case. Thus, corporation is now precluded from renewing its JMOL motion. Explanation to point 2, 20-30% of your score. Even if corporation had preserved its right to file, or renew the motion for JMOL after the verdict, the motion should still be denied, because corporation has not advanced arguments that justify granting such a motion. A motion for JMOL at the close of all the evidence, or a renewed motion after the return of the verdict can be granted only if there is no legally sufficient evidentiary basis for a reasonable jury to find for the party opposing the movement. In ruling on such a motion, the trial judge is not authorized to weigh the evidence, pass on credibility of witnesses, or otherwise substitute the judge's view of the evidence for the jury's view. The standard expressed in Rule 50, makes clear that the grant of a motion for JMOL is a performance of the court's duty to assure enforcement of the controlling law, and is not an intrusion on any responsibility for factual determinations conferred on the jury by the Seventh Amendment. This standard is also used as a reference point for entry of summary judgment under Rule 56. Thus, corporation's argument that its evidence was more persuasive and more credible than plaintiff's evidence, does not provide the court with a basis for overturning the jury's verdict. Even if true, the superior strength of corporation's evidence does not mean that the jury acted unreasonably by returning a verdict for plaintiff. Similarly, even if the trial judge agrees with corporation that its witnesses were more credible than the witnesses for plaintiff, that fact still would be insufficient to support a motion for JMOL. Assessments of witness credibility are core jury functions, and Rule 50 does not give the judge license to usurp that core function. The verdict may be overturned only if, on the basis of the evidence, no reasonable jury could have found that plaintiff had met her burden of proof. Here the jury had an objective and reasonable basis for accepting plaintiff's version of the facts, the suspicious timing of plaintiff's firing, and the testimony by a witness to the discriminatory statements by plaintiff's supervisor. Even if the trial court thinks the jury erred, the trial court should defer to the jury's choice between competing versions of events, when the jury choice is reasonably based on the evidence presented in the case. Explanation to point 3, 20-30% of your score. Corporation's alternative motion for a new trial should be granted if the court is convinced that the jury's verdict was clearly against the weight of the evidence and a miscarriage of justice, but such a result is unlikely here. Corporation's motion for a new trial was filed within 10 days of the entry of judgment, as required by Rule 59. Unlike motions for JMOL, Under Rule 50, no pre-verdict motions are required in order to make the post-verdict motion for a new trial. Thus, corporation's alternative motion for a new trial is procedurally proper, and can be considered on the merits. Rule 59 does not specify any standard for the granting of a new trial, but instead provides that such motions can be granted for any of the reasons for which new trials have been granted in actions at law in courts of the United States. In effect, Rule 59 gives the trial judge power and discretion to prevent a miscarriage of justice. Because an order for a new trial is not a final judgment, such motions are more freely granted than are motions for JMOL. In general, the grounds for a new trial are that the verdict is against the weight of the evidence, that the damages are excessive, or that for other reasons, such as errors of law, the trial was not fair. Where the court is convinced that a mistake has been made, such as where the prevailing party's witnesses were wholly lacking in credibility, a new trial may be ordered. On a motion for new trial, unlike a motion for JMOL, the court is not required to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict winner. In this case, the first ground offered in support of the motion is corporation's argument that its evidence was more persuasive and more credible than plaintiff's evidence. Because the court is free to weigh the evidence itself on a motion for new trial, this argument may prevail. Courts have held that an order for a new trial is appropriate when the trial judge is convinced that the jury has reached a seriously erroneous result. However, the trial judge must respect the collective wisdom of the jury. It is not proper for a court to grant a new trial on the ground that the verdict is against the weight of the evidence unless the record shows that the jury's verdict resulted in a miscarriage of justice. Since the credibility of witnesses is specifically for the jury, it is an invasion of the jury's province to grant a new trial merely because the evidence was sharply in conflict. The issue here is simple, and the facts were highly disputed at trial. Notwithstanding the fact that the court may believe that corporation's evidence was more persuasive, it would be improper for the court to grant corporation's motion for a new trial on this basis. Explanation to point 4, 20-30% of your score. Corporation's motion for a new trial should be granted if a juror improperly failed to reveal information that would bias that juror against corporation. Corporation's second argument in support of a grant of a new trial is stronger. By showing that a juror improperly failed to disclose information that would bias the juror against corporation, corporation has identified an error that could have influenced the verdict. Through questions during voir dire, jurors are screened for potential bias. Although motions for a new trial based on juror non-disclosures during voir dire are often unsuccessful, if the withheld information would have justified a disqualification for cause, a new trial should be granted. Here, had corporation known of the juror's prior experience with employment discrimination suits, and her hostility toward companies that are accused of discrimination, corporation surely would have moved that the potential juror be struck for cause. Of course, the fact that a juror has potential biases is not enough to warrant striking the juror from the jury for cause. The question is whether those potential biases are also actual biases. Here, there is evidence that the jury foreperson had actual bias, and manifested that bias even before the trial began. Under these circumstances, the trial court could find that the jury foreperson's apparent bias against corporation fundamentally undermined the fairness of the trial. If the court so concludes, it should grant corporation's motion for a new trial. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Question 7. On October 1, DART Corporation, hereinafter referred to as DC, a state AE corporation, borrowed $300,000 from State Bank, a state AE bank. On behalf of DC, DC's president signed a written security agreement, giving State Bank a security interest in DC's State Bank checking account, which was a demand account, to secure its obligation to repay the loan. State Bank did not file a financing statement reflecting that interest. On December 1, First Bank, another state AE bank, agreed to loan $60,000 to DC. DC's president, on behalf of DC, signed a written security agreement granting First Bank a security interest in all of DC's office equipment and deposit accounts. First Bank immediately advanced $60,000 to DC, and filed a financing statement reflecting its interest. First Bank's financing statement was filed in the correct filing office in State AE, and listed the collateral as office equipment and deposit accounts. It correctly identified First Bank as the secured party, and it correctly gave the address of the debtor as 123 Smith Street, City, State AE. However, First Bank's financing statement incorrectly listed the name of the debtor as Darkt Incorporated, rather than Darkt Corporation, which was the correct name of the company as reflected on its certificate of incorporation and other public records. Despite this error, a search under the name Darkt Corporation, using the State AE Filing Office's standard search logic, would turn up the financing statement listing Darkt Incorporated as the debtor. Shortly after receiving the loan from First Bank, DC defaulted on the obligations it owed to State Bank and First Bank. On December 23, State Bank obtained a judgment against DC, in connection with its unpaid $300,000 loan. On January 3 of the following year, a State AE sheriff levied on DC's office equipment on behalf of State Bank. 1. As between First Bank and State Bank, which has a superior claim to DC's checking account at State Bank. Explain. 2. As between First Bank and State Bank, which has a superior claim to DC's office equipment. Explain. Multi-State Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, SEPA ACBA Review, Answer Analysis of Question 7, Secured Transactions. Issue, 1. As between the bank, in which a deposit account is maintained and a bank that has filed a financing statement covering the account, whose security interest in the account has priority. Issue 2a. Is a financing statement effective to perfect a security interest, when the financing statement does not give the debtor's correct name, but a search under the correct name would reveal the financing statement? Issue 2b. Does a perfected security interest have priority over a judicial lien that has attached to collateral? Answer discussion. A security interest in a deposit account is perfected only if the secured party has control of the account. First Bank did not have control of the deposit account, State Bank did. Thus, State Bank's interest is the only perfected interest, and State Bank's claim is superior to First Bank's claim. First Bank's interest in Darkt Corporation's office equipment was perfected even though its financing statement gave an incorrect name for Darkt Corporation, hereinafter referred to as DC. Because a search of the filing office records using DC's correct name would disclose the financing statement, it is effective to perfect First Bank's interest. Because First Bank is a perfected secured party, its interest prevails over the interest of State Bank, a judgment creditor whose lien attached after First Bank had perfected its interest. Explanation to point 1, 45-55% of your score. First Bank did not have control of DC's deposit account at State Bank. As a result, First Bank's interest is unperfected, and is subordinate to State Bank's perfected interest, even though First Bank filed a financing statement, and State Bank did not. DC's checking account at State Bank is a deposit account for Article 9 purposes. The facts state that the account is a demand account, and demand accounts are Article 9 deposit accounts. Both State Bank and First Bank have enforceable security interests in the account because the following criteria are fulfilled. 1. DC's president signed a security agreement granting each bank an interest in the account. 2. DC has rights in the account. And 3. Each bank extended value to DC by giving DC a loan. Although First Bank filed a financing statement covering the deposit account, First Bank's interest is not perfected. Under UCC Section 9312, a security interest in a deposit account may be perfected only by control. Under UCC Section 9104, a creditor only has control of a deposit account if, 1. The secured party is the bank with which the deposit account is maintained. Here, the bank account is at State Bank, not First Bank. 2. The bank where the account is held has agreed in writing to follow the instructions of the secured party. Here, no such agreement exists. Or, 3. The secured party becomes the bank's customer with respect to the account, which was not done. Because none of the UCC Section 9104 requirements for control has been met by First Bank, First Bank's security interest in the bank account is unperfected. State Bank, on the other hand, does have a perfected security interest in the deposit account, even though it did not file a financing statement, because State Bank is the bank with which the deposit account is maintained, and therefore has control of the account. As between an unperfected secured creditor, that is, First Bank, and a perfected secured creditor, State Bank, the perfected secured creditor has the superior claim to the collateral. Explanation to point 2a. 20-30% of your score. First Bank's security interest in DC's office equipment is perfected despite the error in DC's name on the financing statement. First Bank filed a financing statement covering DC's office equipment. For a financing statement to be effective under UCC Section 9502, it must contain three pieces of information. 1. The name of the debtor. 2. The name of the secured party. And 3. An indication of the collateral. In the case of First Bank's financing statement, the name of the secured party is correct, and the collateral is sufficiently indicated as office equipment. DC's office equipment would be categorized as equipment under Article 9, the name of the debtor, however, contains an error. The issue is whether this error renders the financing statement ineffective. Under UCC Section 9506, minor errors do not render a financing statement ineffective, unless those errors make the financing statement seriously misleading. However, a corporation is a registered organization, and under Section 9503, a financing statement sufficiently states the name of a registered organization only if the financing statement provides the name of the organization that is indicated on the public record that shows the debtor to have been organized. Here, the financing statement should have stated the debtor's name as DART Corporation. Moreover, under Section 9506, a financing statement that fails sufficiently to provide the name of the debtor in accordance with Section 9503 is seriously misleading. Thus, First Bank's failure to include DC's correct name on the financing statement raises the possibility that the financing statement will be deemed seriously misleading, and therefore ineffective. Luckily, for First Bank, however, UCC Section 9506 provides a safe harbor that deals with this situation. Even where the debtor's name is incorrect on the financing statement, if a search of the records of the filing office under the debtor's correct name, using the filing office's standard search logic, if any, would disclose a financing statement that otherwise fails to provide the name of the debtor, the name provided does not make the financing statement seriously misleading. The facts state that a search in the State A filing office using DC's correct name, DART Corporation, will turn up the filed financing statement, even though it incorrectly states the name of the debtor as DART Incorporated. As a result, First Bank's financing statement is not seriously misleading under the relevant Article 9 provisions, and First Bank's interest is perfected. Explanation to point 2b. 20-30% of your score. First Bank's perfected security interest in the office equipment is superior to State Bank's judgment lien. First Bank's claim to the office equipment is superior to State Bank's claim. First Bank is a perfected secured creditor, and State Bank is a judgment lien creditor. Under UCC Section 9317, a judgment lien creditor takes priority over a security interest only if the creditor becomes a lien creditor before the conflicting security interest is perfected. State Bank became a lien creditor when the sheriff levied, on January 3. First Bank, however, perfected its security interest in the office equipment by filing on December 1, a month earlier. Multi-State Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Question 8. On April 10, a convenience store was robbed by someone carrying a gun. The store's video camera caught the robbery on tape. The tape was shown on the evening news. On April 11, an anonymous caller contacted the police saying, "I saw the tape of the robbery. The robber, kind of looks like student. He's an 18-year-old student at the high school." On April 12, two police officers took the tape to the high school, and showed it to the principal, who said, "It could be student. It's hard to tell because the tape is not clear." The tape was also shown to student's homeroom teacher, who said, "It might be him, but I couldn't say for sure." Later that day, the police officers went to the store where student works after school. They asked the manager if they could talk with student, who was called to the manager's office. The police introduced themselves to student and said, "We'd like to talk to you." They walked with student into the manager's office and shut the door. One police officer sat behind the manager's desk. The other, in full uniform, with his revolver visible, sat near the door. Student sat between them. The manager's office measures 8 feet by 10 feet. The police officers told student they wanted to ask him some questions about the convenience store robbery, on April 10. Student said he knew nothing about a robbery. He continued to deny that he had any knowledge of the robbery, for about 20 minutes. Student did not ask to leave, and neither police officer told student he was free to leave. After about 20 minutes, the police officers told student that they had a videotape of the robbery, and that they had shown it to 3 people, all of whom positively identified student as the robber. Student said nothing for a few minutes. One of the police officers then said, "You know, if we can tell the prosecutor that you cooperated, she might go a lot easier on you. I'd hate to see you end up doing a long stretch in prison. Let's just say it's not a nice place." Student then blurted out, "I did the robbery. I used a little air gun." Immediately after student made that statement, the police officers informed student that he was under arrest for the robbery of the convenience store. They read him his Miranda rights. Student stated he understood his Miranda rights and told the police officers that he was not going to say anything more to them. The police officers placed student in handcuffs and took him to the police station, where he was booked for armed robbery. Student had had 2 earlier brushes with the law. When he was 16, he had been found delinquent in juvenile court for auto theft, and had been placed on supervision for 1 year. When he was 17, he had received a ticket for underage drinking and had paid a fine of $150. He is a C student, but his teachers believe he is an underachiever. Student's defense attorney has filed a motion to suppress student's statements on 3 grounds. 1. Student's statements were obtained in violation of student's Fourth Amendment rights. 2. Student's statements were obtained in violation of his Miranda rights. 3. Student's confession was not voluntary. How should the trial court rule on each of the grounds in the motion to suppress? Explain. Multi-State Essay Questions and Answers, February 2008, Separac Bar Review, Answer Analysis of Question 8, Criminal Law and Procedure. Issue 1. Did the police interview of student violate student's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable seizure, such that students' statements, including the confession, should be suppressed as fruit of the poisonous tree. Issue 2. Should students' statements be suppressed because the police failed to read him his Miranda rights when they questioned him in the manager's office? Issue 3. Should students' confession be suppressed because it was involuntary? Answer discussion. Student was seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment when he was brought into the manager's office to be questioned by the police. However, that seizure did not violate student's Fourth Amendment rights, because the police had reasonable, articulable suspicion that student had been the perpetrator of an armed robbery. This allowed them to detain him for the purposes of investigation, and will not taint any statements that student made during the detention. Whether the police were required to read student his Miranda warnings depends on whether he was subject to in-custody interrogation. In this case, the only real question is whether student was in custody. Applying the objective standard, student was probably not in custody when he spoke with the officers in the manager's office, and Miranda warnings were not required. The last question is whether student's confession to the officers was voluntary, or whether it was the product of police coercion that overcame student's will. Here a court must look at the totality of the circumstances in ruling on the voluntariness of the confession. Most courts would probably conclude that student's confession was voluntary. Explanation to point 1, 25-35% of your score. Student was seized by the police within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, but the seizure was a lawful investigative detention. Student has a Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable seizure. However, this Fourth Amendment right was violated in this case only if, a. student was in fact seized by the police when they spoke with him in the manager's office, and, b. that seizure was unreasonable for Fourth Amendment purposes. If the seizure did violate student's Fourth Amendment rights, then student's statements would be suppressible because they were the direct result of that seizure, that is, the fruit of the poisonous tree. A person has been seized, if in light of all of the circumstances, a reasonable person would have believed that he was not free to leave. In this case, a court could legitimately find that student was seized by law enforcement. Student was taken into his manager's office where he remained for approximately 25 minutes with two police officers, one of whom had a visible weapon. One officer sat between student and the door, and the door was closed. Student was not told that he was free to leave. Under these circumstances, a reasonable person in student's position would probably have believed that he was required to stay in the room until the police officers gave him permission to leave. Assuming that there was a seizure, the next question is whether it was a violation of student's Fourth Amendment rights. Although the police did not have probable cause to arrest student for the armed robbery, the Fourth Amendment permits detention of an individual for a relatively brief period of time, if the police have a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the individual in question had been recently involved in criminal activity. In this case, three people said that the person on the tape of the convenience store robbery could be, might be, and looked like student. These identifications, although far from certain, gave the law enforcement officers sufficient specific facts to form the basis of a reasonable suspicion that student was the robber. The fact that one of the identifiers was an anonymous caller does not affect the reasonableness of law enforcement's actions, since the police officers corroborated the possible identification with student's principal and student's homeroom teacher. Thus, student's Fourth Amendment rights were not violated, and his statements should not be suppressed. Explanation to point 2, 30-40% of your score. The police were probably not required to read student the Miranda warnings because he was probably not in custody until they placed him under arrest. Law enforcement officers are required to read Miranda warnings to a suspect when the suspect is subjected to an in-custody interrogation. If the officers were required to read the warnings and failed to do so, the statements should be suppressed. Student was clearly subject to interrogation, which has been defined not only as questioning initiated by law enforcement, but as any words or actions on the part of the police, that the police should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response from the suspect. The only question then is whether student was in custody when he was being questioned. Custody is a substantial seizure, and is defined as either a formal arrest, or restraint on freedom of movement, of the degree associated with a formal arrest. A suspect need not be in a police station to be in custody. Whether a suspect is in custody is determined by how a reasonable person in the suspect's situation would perceive his circumstances. In assessing the question of custody, courts consider the facts surrounding the interrogation. The test to be applied is purely objective. Therefore, a suspect's age, experience, and other personal characteristics are not considered. In this case, two police officers had student summoned to the manager's office, into which they escorted him and closed the door. Student was outnumbered 2-1, and one officer, with a visible firearm, sat between student and the door. The police did not tell student that he was free to leave. Nonetheless, student was probably not in custody. The police officers told student that they would like to talk with him. He was not told that he was under arrest until the end of the interview. During the interview, student was not in any restraints, the two officers were seated in chairs, and the interview took place in an office. While student may not have felt that he was free to leave, a reasonable person would probably not have believed that he had been arrested, or otherwise taken into formal custody. If student was not in custody, then the police were not required to read him Miranda warnings before talking with him. Therefore, there should be no suppression for a Miranda violation. Explanation to point 3, 25-35% of your score. Based on the totality of the circumstances, student's confession was probably voluntary. The voluntariness of a confession is based on, 1. Whether the police subjected the suspect to coercive conduct, and, 2. Whether the conduct was sufficient to overcome the will of the suspect. There is certainly some evidence of coercion. Here, the police interviewed student in a small, closed room, 2-1, with a firearm displayed. The police did not tell student that he was free to go if he chose, did not tell him that he was not obliged to answer their questions, and did not advise him of his Miranda rights. The police also lied to student about the strength of their case. By itself, the lie would not be a ground for suppression. Trickery and deceit do not render a confession inadmissible. Far from making the police a fiduciary of the suspect, the law permits the police to pressure and cajole, conceal material facts, and actively mislead. But in conjunction with the other factors, this deception pushes this case closer to the line of coercion. The more difficult question is whether this coercive conduct was sufficient to overcome the will of the suspect. Here, courts consider the totality of the circumstances and take into account both the conduct of the police, and the suspect's individual characteristics such as age, level of education, and familiarity with the criminal justice system. A court could conclude that the police behavior was insufficiently coercive to have overcome student's will. The facts indicate that student is an adult, 18 years old, of at least average intelligence, and that he has some experience with the juvenile justice system. The interview in his manager's office lasted less than 30 minutes. Although the police statements about the identification were not 100% true, the fact that a suspect has been deceived about the strength of evidence does not automatically render a statement involuntary. The statement by the police officers that the prosecutor might be more lenient when a defendant is young and cooperates, could be construed as an accurate observation of how the justice system operates, rather than as a promise of leniency. Similarly, the police officer's general description of prison as not being a nice place was not a threat, but simply a statement of fact. On the other hand, a court that focuses on student's youth and inexperience might consider the confession to have been involuntary. Student is a high school senior with minimal experience with the criminal justice system. He was questioned in his manager's office by two police officers. His confession was in direct response to police conduct that could be considered overreaching. First, the police deliberately lied about the strength of the evidence against him. When it appeared that student was reacting to that tactic, the police upped the ante by telling him that a confession might result in leniency. Finally, the police officers made what could be taken as a veiled threat about what would happen to student in prison if he did not confess. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Sepher Akbar Review, Question 9. 6 years ago, Settler created a valid inter vivos irrevocable trust. Settler funded the trust with publicly traded securities, named Friend as sole trustee, and directed Friend, as trustee, to distribute all trust income to James, whom Settler had been supporting for several years. Settler also gave James the right to withdraw up to 5% of the trust's principal annually, during the first 10 years of the trust's existence. 4 years ago, Friend sold all of the trust's publicly traded securities, and reinvested 45% of the proceeds in the preferred stock of A Corp, 45% of the proceeds in the preferred stock of B Corp, and 10% of the proceeds in different publicly traded securities. Both A Corp and B Corp were closely held companies that were newly organized and cash poor. Their preferred stocks were not publicly traded, and were subject to valid restraints on alienation, that effectively made them non-transferable by the trustee for the next 10 years. Furthermore, although both preferred stocks guaranteed an annual 5% dividend, these dividends were not payable until after the 10-year restraint on alienation period had expired. At the time Friend invested in the preferred stocks of A Corp and B Corp, both companies were developing competing technologies to make ballpoint pens that also function as cell phones. Neither company had yet developed working prototypes of the proposed product. Friend honestly believed that the preferred stocks represented a safe investment that would produce returns in excess of those available from any other investment. Friend did not individually own any preferred stock of A Corp or B Corp. However, Friend did individually own 70% of the common stock of A Corp, but had no interest in B Corp. Despite Friend's confidence, the A Corp and B Corp investments have proven disastrous. Since the preferred stocks were purchased, neither company has succeeded in producing a marketable product or making a profit. Both are now near bankruptcy. Moreover, because the stocks have not paid dividends, and cannot be sold, James's income from the trust has declined precipitously. Furthermore, because of the valid restraints on alienation, Friend has truthfully told James that any withdrawal requests cannot be honored. Friend has consulted your law firm, concerned that he may have breached one or more of his fiduciary duties. Explain to Friend which duties, if any, he may have breached in carrying out his responsibilities. Multi-state essay questions and answers, February 2008, Sepher Akbar Review, Answer Analysis of Question 9. Trusts. Issue 1. Did Friend breach the duty of loyalty by investing trust assets in a closely held corporation, in which he had a substantial financial interest? Issue 2. Did Friend breach the duty to invest prudently by investing 90% of trust assets in the illiquid stock of two closely held corporations? Issue 3. Did Friend breach the duty to diversify by investing 90% of trust assets in two corporations with virtually identical businesses? Issue 4. Did Friend breach the duty of care by making investments that produced no current income, and made it impossible for James to exercise his 5% withdrawal power? Answer discussion. Friend breached the duty of loyalty, the duty to invest prudently, the duty to diversify the trust investments, and the duty of care, when he invested 90% of the trust's assets in the preferred stock of two closely held corporations. Friend breached the duty of loyalty because he had a substantial financial interest in one of the closely held corporations. He breached the duty to invest prudently, and the duty to diversify because the investments significantly diminished the liquidity of the trust principal, and because A Corp and B Corp were involved in similar high-risk businesses. He breached the duty of care, by investing in a manner that precluded carrying out the trust's obligations to James with respect to the payment of income, and James's annual 5% withdrawal power. Explanation to point 1, 15 to 25% of your score. Friend breached the duty of loyalty by investing the trust assets in a corporation in which friend, in his individual capacity, had a substantial investment. A trustee owes trust beneficiaries a duty of loyalty, and must administer the trust exclusively in the beneficiary's interests. Because the trustee must act on behalf of the beneficiaries, and not on behalf of himself, the duty of loyalty is breached when a trustee enters into transactions on behalf of the trust that involve a conflict of interest or self-dealing. Friend entered into a transaction involving a conflict of interest. Uniform Trust Code Section 802C provides that an investment in a corporation in which the trustee has an interest that might affect the trustee's best judgment is presumptively a breach of the duty of loyalty. Here, Friend invested in A Corp, in which he held 70% of the common stock. Although the comments to Section 802 note that the presumption of a breach can be rebutted by showing that the terms of the transaction were fair, or that the transaction would have been made by an independent party, there is no evidence to support such a showing in this case. It is also hard to imagine that an independent trustee would have made such a risky and illiquid investment. Explanation to point 2, 25 to 35% of your score. Friend breached the duty to invest prudently by investing the trust assets in the illiquid stocks of cash poor, closely held corporations, without proven marketable products. Almost all states have adopted in one form or another, the Uniform Prudent Investor Act. Under this act, a trustee owes trust beneficiaries a duty to invest trust assets prudently. In assessing whether a trustee has breached this duty, the Act requires consideration of a number of factors, including, 1, the distribution requirements of the trust, 2, general economic conditions, 3, the role the investment plays in relationship to the trust's overall investment portfolio, and, 4, the trust's need for liquidity, regularity of income, and preservation or appreciation of capital. All of these factors support a finding that Friend's investment was imprudent. The investments in A Corp and B Corp represented a very large share, 90%, of the trust assets, and dominated the portfolio. The investments drastically reduced the liquidity of the trust, making it impossible to meet the trust's distribution requirements. The investments also reduced the trust's annual income, resulting in a reduction in mandatory income distributions. The effects of the investments on the trust income and liquidity were not unexpected, but were known at the outset. Moreover, the technologies that both companies planned to develop were unproven, working prototypes that had not been developed, and there was no evidence that such inventions would succeed in the highly competitive cell phone market. Lastly, since the companies were developing competing technologies, there is a good chance that ultimately one of them would fail, for example, Blu-ray versus high-definition DVD. Explanation to point 3, 15 to 25% of your score. Friend breached the duty to diversify, by investing 90% of the trust's assets in two corporations that were involved in the same type of business, and subject to the same market risks. A trustee owes a duty to diversify trust investments unless he reasonably determines that, because of special circumstances, the purposes of the trust are better served without diversifying. The diversification duty rests on the assumption that it is risky to place all, or substantially all of one's assets in the same investment basket. Although there is no automatic rule for identifying how much diversification is enough, It seems highly unlikely that any fact finder would find the investment of 90% of trust assets in one narrow and unproven market sector sufficiently diverse. Additionally, there are no facts in this case to support a finding that a lack of diversification was warranted because of special circumstances. Settler funded the trust with publicly traded securities. The terms of the trust contemplated investments that would produce income and distributable principal. Explanation to point 4, 15-25% of your score. Friend breached the duty of care by investing the trust assets in a manner that precluded administration of the trust, in accordance with its terms and purposes. Under the common law, a trustee owes beneficiaries the duty to act with care, skill, and prudence. Although the Uniform Trust Code does not impose on trustees a duty of care, it does impose a duty to administer the trust in good faith, in accordance with its terms and purposes, and the interests of the beneficiaries. Whichever formulation is used, Friend breached his duty by making investments that made it impossible to carry out the terms of the trust. The facts clearly evidence Settler's intention to provide James with an annual income, and imply that this income may have been intended to supplant the support Settler provided James before creating the trust. The facts also clearly show that Settler gave James the power to annually withdraw up to 5% of trust principal over the first 10 years of the trust. The investments in A Corp and B Corp effectively prevented James from exercising his withdrawal power, and dramatically curtailed his income from the trust.